retipster.com. This is the RE Tipster Podcast. This show is all about using your limited time and energy to invest in real estate with lower risk and bigger rewards. If you want to build more financial freedom from real estate without putting your life savings on the line, this show is for you.
Hey everyone, how's it going? Seth Williams here and Jaron Barnes from the RE Tipster Podcast. This is episode number 45, and for the first time ever, we're having a returning guest, Keith Weinhold. He's the first guy to ever be asked back a second time on the show. So Keith, if you want to hear the first podcast, by the way, you can hear that in episode 29. It's at retipster.com/29. But just to give you a quick recap, Keith Weinhold, he's a member of the Forbes Real Estate Council, an international best-selling author. He owns apartments in Alaska, homes in Texas and Florida, coffee farms in Panama, and cacao farms in Belize. And most notably, he's the founder of GetRichEducation.com, where he runs a blog and podcast, and he teaches readers and listeners all about real estate investing, financial freedom, and how to foster the right financial mindset. So I remember back when we had Keith on the show a few months back, Jaron and I both walked away just kind of with a changed perspective on a number of things. Keith just has this way of, you know, making these statements that kind of go against, you know, conventional wisdom, or almost sound, I don't even know if I'd say the word provocative a little bit, but just makes you stop and say, whoa, seriously? And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about here today, because we covered a number of those things when we had Keith on the show before, but there were several things from the book he wrote called Seven Money Myths That Are Killing Your Wealth Potential. Several of these myths that he outlined in that book that we didn't have time to cover earlier in our conversation with him. So I kind of wanted to go through some of those other ones, because all of them kind of make you think a little bit different, and they make you realize, like, I've been making some improper assumptions about money all along. And I don't know, if we get lucky, maybe we'll even get into a little debate with Keith and go back and forth about, are you sure about that? I don't know. So Stick around. This should be an interesting episode. So Keith, welcome to the show, man. How are you doing?
Thanks. I'm fantastic. You know, it was great that you had me on once. It's a total honor to be your first repeat guest. Glad to be here, fellas.
So I just wanted to jump in there, Keith, and officially say on the air that our last conversation probably changed my life more than any other podcast guest that we've had, because I was caught between two mindsets, kind of Robert Kiyosaki on one side and Dave Ramsey on the other. And I had Dave Ramsey in my ear, debt is evil. And then I had Robert Kiyosaki in my ear, debt is leverage, you know? And like, and for me personally, you really clarified in kind of the previous debate that we had. So I just really want to encourage people to go check out episode 29 and just get the context of, this is going to be somewhat of a follow-up to that. And you'll see a lot of change in my perspective as we dive into these myths. So just wanted to officially thank you, man.
Yeah, sure thing. I think from episode 29, maybe one summary sentence was financially free beats debt free.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, and those things are not necessarily the same thing, which a lot of people don't seem to understand the differentiator between that.
That's right, and it's counterintuitive. And, you know, why do people struggle with this, and why do people say things that actually don't make a lot of sense? Like, at all costs, I want to retire my debt. That's because when you believe the same old thing for so long, and you're inside a culture, and you probably have a circle of friends and family that believe this same thing, every one of those people never having a formal financial education, then it's really hard to change. And that's why some people go through this catharsis where they really need to maybe listen to an episode like episode 29 of RE Tipster and then think it through themselves for a while. That's why it takes a while to wrap one's mind around it.
Yeah, and it is interesting, because a lot of the myths we're about to cover here are like word for word things that I've heard my whole life from people who struggle with money. So it is kind of interesting. But I mean, even then, like, it's still hard for me to shake, you know, the idea that this is truth when it might not necessarily be that simple. There's more to the story. So,
well, there is. I mean, let me tell you, I am a person right now that wants to get to the point where I have $10 million in debt. I currently have several million dollars in debt. And an intermediate term goal is to get $10 million in debt, which sounds completely irresponsible to the everyday person that lives in the consumer credit workaday job world.
Throwing that around at a cocktail party would be something that raises some eyebrows, let me tell you. I mean, I could just imagine sitting there being like, yeah, so what's your like next 3 to 5 year goals? Yeah, I want to be get into like $10 million worth of debt. Sounds like a good idea, you know?
Yeah, I mean, totally. If you say that at a cocktail party, if a person would even talk to you anymore, it's, you know, what you talking about, Willis? You know, $10 million, you know, we need to have at least a 5 minute chat to explain this. It just doesn't make sense. It's counterintuitive. And, you know, I think when it comes to debt and financially free beats debt free, there's really a differentiating question where, you know, if you are at a cocktail party, you could ask a person or pass this through the filter of, look, here's a key question in determining an abundant mindset and someone that might be a savvy investor versus a scarce mindset and someone that's fear-based. And that question is, if you could borrow money at 0%, how much would you want to borrow? I think some people would say none because they're scared and they don't know how to invest and they don't know how to create arbitrage. My answer to that question would be I would want to borrow as much at 0% as I possibly could. Yeah. And I would want to take as long as I possibly could to pay you back as well, because I feel like I know what to do with that money. It doesn't take a very good investor to borrow at 0% and invest at a higher rate, but that introduces fear for some people.
Yeah. And essentially, I mean, if you've got, you know, an asset that throws off enough cash flow to more than pay for your debt service, I mean, it sort of is 0% or less than 0%, right? Like the net effect of that. So that's an interesting way of framing that.
Huh. Yeah. So let's break that down. If you borrowed money at 0%, just say that the real rate of inflation is 3%. Well, Seth, if I borrowed $10 million from you at 0%, I would want to say yes to that. And inflation is 3%, and I can just pay you back, and you know, there isn't any inflation adjustment, there isn't any interest rate, it's a 0% interest rate. At the end of year one, basically in inflation-adjusted dollars, now I only owe you $9.7 million. And after year two at this 3% inflation rate, now the effective amount that I need to pay you back is $9.4 million. So just from the perspective that I've borrowed at less than the rate of prevailing inflation, at less than the rate of the diminished purchasing power of the dollar, I'm already ahead. So of course, I want to borrow as much from you as I can, and I want to pay that back over as long a period of time as I possibly can. Now, deflation would erode that, but most people think we're going to be in more of an inflationary environment than a deflationary environment. Just align your interests with what the Fed's doing and with what the U.S. government does. We have $22 trillion in debt. So the United States wants to debase the dollar to make it easier for them to pay back their creditors. They don't want deflation to take place. So as an investor, we want to align our interests with forces more powerful than us, like the Fed, and the motivation to continue to debase the dollar. The Fed has been in creation since 1913. That's 106 years. The long-term trend of the dollar is that it goes lower and lower and lower. And the dollar today only has about 3% as much purchasing power as it did 100 years ago. It's been debased 97%, and that is going to continue to happen. So I want to be a borrower. Inflation impoverishes savers, and inflation enriches borrowers.
Man, I got to tell you, I think that this is the first conversation I've ever had in my life where somebody talks about the government debt as a good thing. Like, you have a very exactly. just like counterculture. Your mindset is just very counterculture to most people that I hang out with. Here's my question for you. Would you say that debt and leverage is a good move for every single person, whether they're entrepreneurial in nature or not? Would you say across the board, debt is a good thing?
No, I definitely would not. It's not a good thing in a few circumstances. Sometimes debt might not be even available to you in the real estate world if you want to buy a property that's unfinanceable. In that case, you would need to pay cash for it, then hopefully bring that property up to a financeable condition and then take the cash out. Also, I think debt is a bad idea. And this is a great question, Jaron, because there's, you know, consumer-driven debt. You know, to borrow on a 21% APR credit card to go on a Caribbean cruise. That's not responsible. You have to pay that debt yourself. In a cash flowing rental, you have the ability to outsource the debt. So there are a number of examples where I don't think it's a good idea for a person to be a borrower. Even if you borrow on a mortgage at 5 or 6% interest rate for a non-owner occupied property, if the cap rate and cash flow don't make sense and you know you don't understand that perspective, then I think borrowing is irresponsible. So yeah, you definitely need to be a responsible borrower, and that's what helps differentiate bad debt from smart debt. For example, I want $10 million of strategic smart debt.
What if you were to ask the question, you know, are guns a good thing or are guns a bad thing? It's like guns can be good or bad. If you shoot yourself with it, they're bad. Or if you murder somebody, they're bad. If you protect yourself with it, if you use them to win World War II or something like that, then they're probably good. So it really kind of depends on how you use it.
That's a lovely analogy. Do guns kill people or do people kill people? So yeah, I love it. Now I brought up this $10 million thing, you know, a couple times. And, you know, I think when someone first hear that, and this is part of the book, you know, one chapter of my book, Seven Money Myths That Are Killing Your Wealth Potential, is that you want to be debt-free. Well, $10 million in debt, to the layperson, that sounds like a terrible place to be. In fact, if I would have heard that maybe, you know, back when I were in high school, I would have thought that were awful. But then you learn there's something called net worth where, well, that person might have $30 million in assets if that person has $10 million in debt, the difference being $20 million of positive net worth. And then when you're around the finance world a little more, you know, you come across the perspective that, you know what, for someone to get $10 million in debt, they must have been awfully credit worthy for people to even loan them that amount of money. And I'm talking about $10 million where I have taken out loans for cash flowing income properties. So I've outsourced the debt in a cash flowing property, meaning that the rent income exceed all the monthly expenses, principal, interest, taxes, insurance, maintenance, repairs, utilities, management. As long as that's a positive number, I want to continue to borrow money because the tenant pays the mortgage interest. The tenant also pays down a piece of the principal. And on top of that, I get cash flow. So not only have I outsourced the debt, I've created a passive income stream. That's why I want $10 million in good debt. We're not talking about net worth. We're just talking about the debt side of the column.
So how do you prepare yourself when you're borrowing for the economy crashing or something negatively impacting? Because the more leveraged you are, the more risk you have, right? Because if you have all these rental properties and the local economy tanks, then all of a sudden it reverses on you and you're underwater. Now you have all this debt that you're on the hook for and you're stuck. So how do you navigate that whole conversation?
Yeah, great question. I don't think there's such thing as risk zero. You're talking about me taking on more leverage, taking on more debt, and how that increases risk. I think it can if it's done a certain way, but that can be navigated. And I feel like I'm actually reducing risk when I do something like take equity out of my home and transfer it into an income property. Now I've actually reduced risk because when I do that, I haven't lost any equity. I've merely transferred equity from my primary residence into an income property that produces income. And here's one part that reduces the risk in that equation is the fact that now I have the ability to be diversified and invested in two geographic markets. And just coincidentally, thank God I operate that way because I actually live in a market, Anchorage, Alaska, that's been in an economic recession. So thank goodness I've been separating money from my home these past few years. I've actually reduced my debt. All my debt's outsourced. It's cash flowing. And now I'm geographically diverse. The market is often more important than the property in real estate. As we know, an income-producing property only produces income if you have a rent-paying tenant and that tenant has a job in a viable economy. So it's risk reduction by removing equity from my home because equity has been harvested, not lost.
Let me lean in there a little bit, and I'm going to try to put my Seth Williams hat on. I'm going to try to be like Seth here for a minute. So let's say that you had a bunch of rental properties in Michigan in 2007, and the economy crashes. Yes, I understand that that was a historical event. The likelihood of that happening again to that degree is unlikely. There's ebbs and flows. I get all that. But let's say that you have $10 million worth of debt in the Midwest where, you know, in certain pockets where it's growing, but then something shifts and all of a sudden overnight, your entire portfolio, you know, if let's say your portfolio is worth $30 million, you have $10 million worth of debt overnight, it's all of a sudden, you know, worth $2 million. What do you do in that situation? How do you navigate that whole thing? Do you liquidate your assets? Do you go like become an alcoholic? Like, what do you do to handle all that? Do you just hold it and then just ride it out, you know, believing that the economy will rebound eventually? What do you do?
Yeah, the short story is if I lost capital value in my properties, I would hold out. So you bring up a few interesting things, Jared, and you're great at playing a provocateur. I love it. This is what makes for a good back and forth. I wouldn't be invested only in Michigan if I lived in Michigan, for example. I invested in multiple markets. Even in the economic downturn of 2007 to 2009, by the way, I was investing then. I bought my first fourplex building in 2002. I started young. So, you know, I did live and actually thrive in a recession because I bought for cash flow. So even though that was the greatest economic downturn that we've seen since 1929 in the Great Depression, I still thrived during the Great Recession because I bought based on the production of cash flow. You know, in 2007, I bought my second fourplex building. It was in Anchorage, Alaska. I bought it for $530,000. A year or two later, it was only worth about $480,000. I got to tell you, that didn't feel good. $530,000 down to $480,000. $50,000 of equity just gone and evaporated. I only put a 10% down payment on that building, so all my equity was gone. But then I soon realized I bought for cash flow. Not only that, but when the mortgage market dried up and renters couldn't get loans to go be a first-time home buyer, they had to become my renter. So now my rent income was greater than it had ever been. And how incentivized am I to want to liquidate an asset when it was temporarily suppressed in value, but when it's paying me better than it's ever paid me, even if the value where I had bought for 530, had it gone below 480 down to even 280, it's paying me better than it ever had to hold on to it. So as long as I buy for cash flow and in diverse markets, I can kind of play both sides of this. But the thing I don't want to do, and I'm really glad you brought this up, Jaron, is buy a property knowing that for there's some reason in my life I need to sell it in 5 years because like my kid's getting ready to go to college or something. I think that's an awful strategy. So the short story, you probably heard it before, is buy for cash flow, but not just in one market because there's more risk associated with that than what a lot of people think. It's being in multiple geographic markets for diversity. Again, the market is more important than the property.
I want to kind of start jumping into some of these myths a little bit. Myth number one in your book, you say live below your means.
Yeah.
That's a myth. Why do you say that's a myth?
That's terrible advice. If one tries to live below their means, oftentimes they're trying to be frugal, they're trying to settle, they're trying to postpone experiences in life, many of which they never have. When you try to reduce your expenses and maybe build systems in your life to save a dollar on Raisin Bran at the grocery store, you can only cut your quality of life to the downside so far. And when you do cut your quality of life to the downside, you're living worse anyway. That's an example of living below your means. Instead, you could expand your means. Living below your means might be spending your time, your most valuable resource, spending 20 minutes in line at Chick-fil-A to get a free Chick-fil-A sandwich. Well, instead, you could spend those 20 minutes, for example, learning how to improve your credit score so you could get the lowest mortgage interest rate. So I think, in short, don't live below your means, expand your means, is focus on production rather than reduction.
Yeah. What it sounds to me, because I think in that, I can't remember exactly what you said in your book, but I think you came out and said, I'm not saying to live beyond your means. I'm just saying don't stop at live below your means. So it almost sounds like it's not that live below your means is the wrong advice. It's just that it shouldn't stop there. Like that's not the end of the story. The point is to expand your means. Is that accurate or am I missing something there?
Yeah, I think I would agree with living within your means. I think that makes some sense. But intentionally going out of your way to live below your means and you know, save some coupon website to your favorites, when instead you could learn about how to use leverage and arbitrage to build wealth. That's maybe another difference of living below your means versus expanding your means. Living within your means can be a good thing to do, but you don't even want to do that all the time, or you never expand your comfort zone. And growth happens when you push the limits of your comfort zone a little bit, kind of like the $10 million in debt that I brought up.
I like this conversation from a mindset standpoint. I think that it's very healthy to not have this approach to life of, let me pinch my pennies, let me go to drive across town so that I can save $2 at this grocery store. Like, I love that. That's very much, it's very interesting because I'm just naturally not like that. And I have friends that are in my life that are very frugal just in nature, and they pride themselves. It's almost this like cultural thing in the Midwest, I guess, where people are like, the more frugal you are, the just better character you have or what have you, right? But it's easier said than done when you just say, oh, just increase your income, right? Like, that's very flippant. And so where I would want to kind of dive in and ask you, kind of hone in on this perspective, is when you are struggling financially and it's hard to make ends meet, and you're at that point where you're like, well, I just need to increase my income. Like, what do you practically do to do that? Because that's
a great question. Yeah, that's what I was wondering too.
Yeah, it's really hard to just flip a switch. Oh, today I'm just going to be a millionaire. It's going to be great.
Well, the short answer is learn more. But, you know, I will tell you, Jaron, that I think in a sense you're right. I agree. It takes more effort and more thinking to increase your income than it does to reduce your expenses. There actually is some more friction there. You do need to learn some new things. You do need to walk out on a limb a little bit. And you do need to feel a little bit of that fear and pressing your comfort zone. You know, someone that lives below their means and, yeah, taking a 5-minute detour on the way home to stop at the gas station where you save 8 cents a gallon on gasoline. Well, okay. I mean, maybe even
from laughing because I have a friend that I've known for years that just keeps coming up in mind. And Seth, it's not you, I promise. it's like this. Anyway, it's this guy that he's now moved, but he lived in Indianapolis when I moved out there. And it's just really funny because as you're talking, like, he would do stuff like that. And I'd always be like, dude, what are you doing? Like, you're going to save like $5 at the end of the month? Like, calm down. Just go buy a donut or something.
Well, so. Okay, let's talk about something else that's actionable. And this is in the book that you're asking me about, the book I published almost 2 years ago now. And that is an easy way to increase your income is give yourself a pay raise. Don't go to your boss and ask your boss for a pay raise and get all worked up and think about how you need to ask about it and get nervous about the approach. Don't ask your boss for a pay raise. Give yourself a pay raise. All right, what am I talking about? How do you give yourself a pay raise? Well, it's a lot easier and faster and more effective than ever asking your boss. It's by stop reducing your salary by contributing to a 401k plan or similarly a 403b plan or a 457. Actually, those plans, the 401k, I interviewed the very founder, the inventor of the 401k, and he confirmed this with me. In the early 80s, when 401k plans were rolled out, Seth and Jaron, they were actually called salary reduction plans, but they had to soon scrap the name to foster participation. But 401ks still principally reduce your salary. As soon as you opt out of 401k contributions, you've effectively given yourself a pay raise. So not only have you given yourself a pay raise, but beyond a pay raise, now you can increase your income again if you take that money that you were contributing in your 401k and contribute to something that produces income for you every month and has as many or probably more tax benefits than a 401k. Investing in cash flowing property, it doesn't only benefit you in retirement like a 401k does. It benefits you both now and in retirement. So if you're trying to find ways with little friction to increase your income, start giving yourself a pay raise and stop voluntarily reducing your salary. That's very actionable and that's very easy, but you need to think it through because, again, you know, this fear comes in because that's not what most people do. But if you don't want to be like most people, you need to do something differently from most people.
In order to accumulate enough cash to then invest in something like real estate that pays you income, that requires you to live below your means, right?
That was going to be my question.
You can't spend that money, so you kind of do have to live below your means. Or am I missing something?
Well, instead of making $20,000 in 401k contributions this year, if you shifted that over into real estate, then you wouldn't reduce your quality of life if you went ahead and transferred that over. But yeah, if you're not doing any investing right now, then you would temporarily have to reduce your quality of life only if you're in that situation. But in either case, you're creating a monthly income stream, income that you don't have to work for.
In the pursuit of increasing your income, if temporarily you needed to pinch pennies in order to do something like, let me give a very practical example. I am living in Chicago. Chicago's relatively expensive.
Yeah.
I spend about $1,500 a month in a rent payment. And there's a bunch of other really annoying kind of stupid tax on Chicago. Like I have to pay $800 a year for a parking permit per car. There's a lot of different weird things. So what me and my family have decided to do is we're looking at getting a duplex in northwestern Indiana, living in one side, renting out the other, so that I can substantially reduce my monthly mortgage costs. Because if I can bring that down, that frees up, you know, $1,500 a month, or maybe if I have to pay a little bit, maybe $1,200 a month that I could then use towards investing and potentially increasing my income. But I have some other real estate stuff happening, but just for sake of example, if that's all I had, if all I had was an extra $1,200 a month to dedicate towards increasing my income, there might be a few years of me living in a duplex, which is not an ideal situation, living kind of below my means, so that in the future, I could take that $1,200 and turn it into something that will increase my income further down the road. So would you agree that sometimes in order to make that shift and turn that light switch on of like, okay, don't live below your means, increase your means, that sometimes you have to temporarily change some things around so that you're living cheaper so that you can have freed liquidated assets to invest for a return? Would you agree with that? Or would you say, oh, dude, you're tripping?
I would agree that you could be temporarily living below your means. See, here's the thing. Most people think delayed gratification is a mantra for decades, but that should only be a mantra for the short term. So, Jaron, kind of like you're talking about potentially buying a duplex in Northwest Indiana, which I don't know all the numbers, but I think on its basis, that does make a lot of sense, is, yeah, you might delay some gratification in the short term so that you can live beyond your means in the intermediate term and the long term. Just kind of like my first ever home of any kind was not a single family home. It was a fourplex where with just a 3.5% down payment and an FHA loan, I lived in one unit and rented out the other three. So in a way, I started off with, okay, short term, I could have expanded my means some more, but I know I'm setting myself up for a life of expanding my means. But yeah, there was some delayed gratification in the short term, but that should not be long term. Delayed gratification is not aspirational, which is really what most 401k savers do. You can't tap your 401k until you're between age 59 and a half and 70 and a half. But like with you in your duplex, you can tap the equity sooner. You can build a cash flow stream in the short term. You can reduce your housing expense. But yeah, you probably are only for the short term reducing your quality of life by living on one side of a duplex versus what else you could buy. But you're setting yourself up for a lifetime of expanding your means.
So you are not anti-delayed gratification. That was the takeaway I was looking for.
Yeah, I'm anti-delayed gratification for a long term, for decades, which is how most people think. But that just doesn't make any sense when with so little effort, you can expand your means for the long term.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of like, you know, old school Ecclesiastes wisdom, like there's a time and a place for everything. Like there's always a season in life where certain things make sense, but it's not like a rule to live your entire life by. Like I always just need to be cheap and live below my means.
Yeah, most people never get out of that rut of living below their means.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know, you know, I'm totally painting with broad strokes here, but you know, living in West Michigan, it's kind of a Dutch town. There's lots of Dutch heritage here. And again, not all Dutch people, but there is a stereotype. A lot of Dutch people are like super frugal to a fault. It's almost like they love it. Like they just love spending as little as possible. Even when it's not, even if you're a billionaire, it's like, let's still look for the deal everywhere. And that's always, I don't know. It's never really been how I've wanted to live my life. But I, you know, I couldn't necessarily say that was wrong. I mean, maybe that's why a lot of those people were wealthy. But I think it helps to have this kind of clarity, like, you know, just understanding the difference between just living cheap and actually living a life that is constantly expanding so you don't have to live cheap.
Well, yeah, you bring up something interesting. You know, people that live below their means can often come off as miserly to others. I often pay my real estate agents that I work with, you know, a full 6%, for example, when I sell a property. Well, now how do they look at me? How motivated is that agent to look at me when I pay 6% versus someone else that pays 4%? I get the deals and I don't look as miserly. I'm expanding my means and I'm also helping an agent be a profit and be loyal to me. So, you know, really everywhere I look, I want to look to try to expand my means more so than live below them or even within them.
Yeah. And I know in myth number two in your book, it's actually kind of surprised me at first when I saw it. You said that get your money to work for you, that that's a myth. And the reason that surprised me was because, like, I never even thought about getting my money to work for me until I read books like Rich Dad Poor Dad. Like, that's when that very elementary idea popped into my head. But then to hear you say that's a myth, I was like, what? So what do you mean by that? Why is that not the right way to go about it?
Yeah, myth number 207 is that you should focus on getting your money to work for you. And yeah, it's funny, Seth, you said it. Most people think of working for money, but you know what? It's really only the middle class that think, how can I get my money to work for me? Most people stop right there. It's not very aspirational to only get your money to work for you. The question you need to ask yourself to be aspirational, again, you don't want to do what everyone else does, is ask yourself, how can I ethically get other people's money to work for me? Oh, that must be really complicated or something. No, it isn't. You're doing that with just buy and hold real estate investing. If you buy a $100,000 single family rental home with a $20,000 down payment with a property that provides cash flow, yes, you still can do that a lot of places in the Midwest and South. I know you two guys know that. You both live in the Midwest. But when I do that, I have just ethically employed other people's money three ways at the same time for my gain, and yet I'm providing good in society by providing them with housing. How did I use other people's money three ways simultaneously? The first way is by taking out a loan and using the bank's money for that leverage. The second way is that tenant income stream, my monthly income minus all expenses. And the third way is I'm using the government's money for very generous tax incentives, like a 1031 tax deferred exchange, a mortgage interest deduction, something called depreciation with tax depreciation. The short story on that is typically you don't even need to pay tax on all of your rent income. So I'm using other people's money three ways at the same time when I invest in income property. And had I just put that money in a 401k, I'm merely getting my money to work for me, not others. So, you know, this is conceptually how real estate has made more ordinary people wealthy than anything else. It's ethically employing other people's money, not only my own.
I really want to highlight this for our audience because this was the aha moment post our conversation. Because our conversation, I walked away still chewing and thinking, but then I just had this aha moment that the cash on cash return completely makes Dave Ramsey wrong. I mean, there's the math of the cash on cash return says, like, and I actually had to go to my wife and bring out, I have a whiteboard, and I said, I have to, at four different times, we had to go through the numbers because in our land business, she's very much with this mentality of, no, let's save and use our own money and let's not use investors. Let's not use investors because it always made her feel like it was risky. And I had to show her, no, look, if we use somebody else for acquisition and for marketing costs, we have $0 in the equation. So that means anything that we make is 100% upside. Like the return on investment, when we talk about cash on cash return, is phenomenal. So what you said right here is 100% on point. The more you can use other people's money, the better off it is for you from a financial perspective.
No, you bring up a great point, Jaron, and actually you sort of piggybacked on what I said. I gave the example of making a $20,000 down payment with your own money to leverage $80,000 of other people's money. In the example you're giving, you're kind of saying if you can find someone else's money, even for the 20% down payment, which is possible with things like real estate syndication, now you have zero skin in the game. You've used other people's money a fourth way rather than just a third way. And your ROI is infinite because your skin in the game is zero.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. I'm going to skip over myth three because we kind of covered that already. But moving on to myth number four, compound interest can make you wealthy. You say that that's a myth. What do you mean by that?
In practicality, compound interest doesn't build wealth. Well, wait a second. Compound interest looks awesome when it's plotted on a graph, X and Y axis. Like, I mean, doesn't it go up parabolically? You know, it really looks great on a chart, you know, with a 10% return compounded. I mean, what could be better than compound interest? I'll tell you what's better. It's leverage. Financial leverage builds wealth. But wait, so if you ask me about compound interest, why doesn't it build wealth? Just say a person thinks they're going to get an 8 or 10% return from the S&P 500. You know, you could say that's a reasonable long-term return. But yeah, if you take that 10% return, did you adjust it for inflation? Did you adjust it for emotion, taxes, fees, volatility? I mean, most people have a long-term rate of return of zero from investing in the stock market because they're sold compound interest. But, you know, your traditional financial advisor is just not motivated to tell you that you need to think about inflation. I think you could make the case that the rate of inflation today is 5% when you learn more about how the CPI is calculated and how the government has motivation to suppress the CPI, the consumer price index, because it's politically unpopular to have monetary inflation. If you have 5% inflation off a 10% return, your return's already down to 5%. And we haven't even talked about taxes, fees, volatility, and the emotional component that just can't be discarded, that just predisposes people to want to sell low and buy high, which is the opposite of what you're supposed to do. Because most people get bathed in this media bath, and you know, when they have stocks that they can trade and the market goes down, 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 it's so easy for them to get discouraged and see what they've lost and sell. And then oppositely, when the market goes up, 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 the emotion is momentum. And so many people are making money and they have FOMO and fear of missing out. So then they buy high and they have sold low. I mean, that's the opposite of what you want to do. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about emotion being a deleterious effect on compound interest. Well, real estate's not very liquid. You really have to go through thought processes. Real estate prices are also more stable. So it's less likely you're going to be a victim of emotion in real estate, especially when it's producing that cash flow for you. So compound interest gets graded on by five factors: inflation, emotion, taxes, fees, and volatility.
Why do you think people like jump to the conclusion that like I'm supposed to invest in mutual funds in the stock market? And why? Is it because people selling stocks are getting like fees on that or something? Or why are so many people being pushed in that direction? Maybe it's because it takes very little thought to just plug money into a fund that grows for 30 or 40 years. What are your thoughts on that?
People are busy. They don't take the time to find out the truth. And people have also never had a formal financial education at all. And yeah, Wall Street is so connected with the 401k and all those people have so much financial motivation just to go ahead and keep you in that world. And people are busy in life. They have a lot of things going on. I mean, you know, Jaron and his wife just had a child last month. You've got a full family, Seth. You know, people are interested in, you know, attending their kids' volleyball games on the weekend and, you know, grinding things out at work. People take all this time learning about how work works, zero time learning about how money works, yet money is the only reason that they even go to work. So I really implore people to learn more. But yeah, that's a great point, Seth. People are just busy.
So why do you think if compound interest is not a path for wealth, like Warren Buffett, who's one of the richest men in the world, that guy is smart. He's super rich, right? Like what, he's kind of doubled down on compound interest. Why do you think, like, what would you, if we were having a conversation with Warren Buffett right now, what would you say to him?
Warren Buffett has access to knowledge and deals that we don't. And it actually, Albert Einstein is attributed with saying that compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. I don't know whether he actually said that or not. Some dispel that notion. But yeah, I mean, compound interest works on a graph, but it doesn't work in real life.
Mm-hmm. I can actually, I've read a few books on Warren Buffett and his mentor, Benjamin Graham. And I know he actually had, you know, I don't know if they like came up with the approach, but one of the ways in the very beginning that he would invest in businesses would like find a business where the price of buying the entire business was less than the value of their assets. So like immediately on day one, when you've bought it, you already own something that's worth more than what you paid for it. Hmm. It's actually not that far off of a model from what we do with land, Jaron. Like we buy stuff that's immediately by default worth way more than we paid for in the first place. So it's like, you can't really lose when you sort of back into it that way. And I think like when you're that sophisticated, when you know how to find those kind of deals, when that's the model you're following, that's a very, very, very different ballgame than what most people are doing when they're just buying a stock retirement fund, a target 2045 type thing. Like, I don't know. It's a very different thing. So, you know, I guess those are my thoughts on that.
No, that makes a lot more sense. Yeah, I'm tracking with you guys.
Your average soccer mom isn't going to go down to Edward Jones, and nothing wrong with Edward Jones. I'm just using them as an example. And, you know, buy an entire business at 40 cents on the dollar. It just isn't accessible to everyday people. But like what I've talked about with real estate, that actually is accessible to everyday people, and it gives better returns than most anything else.
I love real estate. The more and more I'm around this world, the more and more I see that. I think real estate in America, specifically in the United States, is one of the most incredible asset classes in the history of mankind. I'm just a big fan. So going into myth number five, you said millionaires got it made. If being a net worth of 1 million or any target number doesn't matter, then what does? I mean, what's a meaningful measure of a person's wealth?
The meaningful measure of a person's wealth, I don't even think it's net worth at all. And I've actually seen authors that I highly respect say that net worth is the ultimate measure of wealth. Net worth, again, being defined as the total value of one's assets minus the total value of one's liabilities. But $1 million, you know, what does that get you? If you have $1 million in net worth today, that doesn't say anything about the cash flow that you have. So cash flow is really the ultimate measure of wealth. If all of your living expenses are $8,000 a month, but you have passive monthly cash flow of $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 a month, you are financially free. So, you know, $1 million with no income coming in and that just sitting there at net worth, that's going to evaporate fast. What if a 45-year-old had that? Over 30 years till age 75, it's just a 4% inflation rate. You would have 308K of purchasing power by age 75. So inflation is wearing things down. And, you know, anymore on the coast, if you have a net worth of $1 million, you know, you're definitely no better than middle class. In the Midwest, that might take you a little bit further. But my point is that people still see being a millionaire as aspirational. And a lot of times your financial advisor that wants you to invest in your 401k might show you a projection with compound interest and say, look, you're guaranteed to be a millionaire in 30 years if you stay on this course of saving. But my point is, you know, what's $1 million really get you? Inflation just continues to erode that and cheapen the meaning of it every day.
Especially in 30 years when you're like old and gray. I mean, that was one thing, that was a big takeaway from the 4-hour work week, was when, you know, Tim Ferriss said that most people wait to enjoy life when they're retired or they're older, and they miss out on their youth. They miss out on their prime. And
yeah, that was a huge takeaway for me for that book too. I know, like, from my days in the banking world, I learned that, like, even if we pretend for a second that your net worth is important, it can be such a BS number. Like, I've seen people, you know, in their liabilities column, they've got all these mortgages and like very serious amounts of debt that, you know, there's huge consequences if they don't pay it back. And then in the assets column, they'll put something like, you know, the value of my business name. Like, the brand I've built is worth, it's like, no, it's not. Or even if it is, like, okay, can you convert that to cash right now? Like, is that cash sitting in your bank account? Because that matters. But, you know, just all this like blue sky, like goodwill stuff that isn't really tangible and is debatable as to whether or not it even exists. But some people can point to that and say, look at me, I'm a millionaire, according to this piece of paper. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've got zero interest in being a mere millionaire. That's not aspirational at all. So if that's the target in your projections, yeah, I think we're all agreeing that you probably want to change your trajectory. You need to do something different. Mm-hmm.
Jumping on to myth number 7, though, Keith, you say that retirement plans are a wise investment. You say that that's a myth. Why do you say that?
Yeah, I think in general, that's a myth. I regret years of contributing to my retirement plan when I used to work at a day job. I quit my day job years ago, by the way. This is a life I actually live off passive real estate. And by the way, if you're listening to a person that talks about how to do something, but they're not doing it themselves, you might need to find a new mentor. But, now if you do get a dollar per dollar match in your 401k, well, that could very well be worth delaying gratification. But yeah, you don't want to delay gratification for long. Yeah, I think we touched on this a little bit. 401ks are salary reduction plans. You have guaranteed that you're reducing your quality of life in the near term, just in the hope, and I'm going to even say the probability of life being a little bit better in the long term. But you can begin taking, again, contributions from your 401k between age 59 and a half and 70 and a half, and you must begin paying taxes on it at that time as well. You must begin paying taxes on it. So you've deferred your tax. You haven't deleted your tax. With real estate in something called a 1031 tax deferred exchange, it is called tax deferred, but there's no limit to the amount of times where you can sell a property, not pay tax on the gain, and roll it forward. So because it's unlimited, you effectively can make it tax-free with your real estate capital gains, but you can't make 401k contributions tax-free. You can defer the tax. And that does help you in the near term with building up money faster and even some help from compounding if you can overcome some of those deleterious effects. But you've just guaranteed that you're deferring life. And what do you really want to do? Like, what's the entire reason we're doing all this, for having this chat about finances? It's because you want to increase your financial freedom. You know, no matter who I talk to or in what medium I communicate through, I have never in my life met a person that says they want less freedom, that they want less of the ability to do whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do it. Everyone wants freedom. Well, then why would you resign yourself to gaining some measure of freedom just beginning in your 60s and 70s when you can do that both now and in the future? I'm really not into the life deferral plan, which is really what 401ks and most retirement plans are.
So what is your thoughts on the self-directed IRA accounts where people can use it to buy real estate?
You can't take any benefit in the short term. Now, you can get a better rate of return overall by moving your money from equities into real estate. But, you know, some people have even found it worthwhile to tear down their 401k and get that money out once they understand cash flow. That's a personal decision. That's even a philosophical decision. How much confidence do you have in your investing ability to know that you can live well both now and in the future? And there are more questions there. But I know a lot of real estate investors that have just skipped over the self-directed IRA and just tear the entire thing down.
I mean, it makes sense to me. I've always had, like, intuitively, I've always kind of had similar approaches to these conversations. But that friend that keeps popping up in my mind, this guy that I see in my head, I mean, we talked until we were blue in the face, where I was like, I would much rather just have a bunch of rental properties when I'm old and, like, not worry about the tax benefits of a retirement account or IRA or whatever. But he, you know, he's actually like a CPA and he's like really entrenched in this finance world. And he's like, no, man, the tax benefits and all this stuff. But I mean, it makes sense to me, because what you're saying essentially is, look, why are you putting your life on hold when you can enjoy your life now and then? You know, if you have to pay a little bit more taxes or whatever, I mean, I guess you can avoid some of the tax hit by using a 1031 exchange, because you can just roll it into the other property and grow your portfolio bigger and bigger and bigger each time that you roll into the next property. But even if you have to pay a little bit more taxes, it gives you access to your wealth now.
That's right. And I mean, we're talking about improving the quality of life, our time on this earth. Our very life is made up of chapters of time. So you want to enhance that time that you have here. It's just, it's really hard to put a price on that.
All right, Keith. Well, hey, man, I really appreciate you sharing all your wisdom with us. It's been really interesting.
It's been a great conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. To close out the show, though, something we've been doing as of late is asking three questions of our guests just to kind of take the conversation one step further, learn a little bit more about how our guests tick. So question number one, what is your biggest fear?
Yeah, that's a big question. And I think I need to get vulnerable with you here in order to answer it.
Yeah.
Everyone has a fear. Most of my fears aren't really around money. I'm pretty abundantly minded. My fear is just something so much more primordial, and that is insignificance. Hmm. And I think a lot of people, you know, across cultures have that feeling, I don't want to be insignificant. My wife and I don't have children. We don't expect to have children. I think a lot of people get this feeling of significance when they, you know, just kind of innately are able to pass something on to their child. So really, my feeling of significance comes from really part of it. And I got to thank you guys is this conduit right now to help affect change and help people live beyond their means. I don't want to be insignificant.
That's really interesting. I think that's something most human beings can relate to, is just the desire to have significance and know that what they're doing matters. And it's interesting, like, there's so many different ways to measure significance.
Yeah.
Like, there's a billion people in China who will never know I existed. Well, next question. Actually, Jaren, you want to ask it?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump on that. So what's something that you're most proud of?
Yeah, most proud of. I'd like to mention two things if I can. Number one is having the ability to overcome fear and make my first ever property a fourplex building in Anchorage, Alaska, back in 2002, where I spent $295,000 of it, which was a lot of money to me. And, you know, being going from a renter myself to being a landlord of three tenants, all that stuff in one fell swoop, that was a big deal. So it's overcoming the fear of buying that first fourplex, which really got me on the road to success. And yeah, I guess the second thing I'm most proud of is I have reached more people with my medium and talking about this stuff than I thought. And yeah, so I'll admit I am pretty proud of that. I never thought I could reach so many people, but of course, we'll see if I get to that level of significance.
Yeah. And last question here, what is the most important lesson you have ever learned?
We've been touching on it. I think it is don't live below your means, expand your means. You've only got one life to live. If you look back on it, are you going to be able to be proud if you said that you lived a life below your means? Or will you be more proud of saying that in your one precious life, you found a way to expand your means? So I'm so glad that we're able to get actionable on some of those things that really set yourself up for expanding your means. I mean, if you could pass one lesson on to your child, expand your means or live below your means, you know, which would you choose? And I think it's pretty apparent.
Yeah. I would tell my children to live a limited life where they can't reach their full potential.
I'd tell them to drive across town to save $2 on gas. You know, yeah.
Don't be significant.
20 cents on gas.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that wraps up the show. Appreciate all the listeners out there for tuning in. So if you guys want to find out more about Keith, he's got an amazing podcast, the Get Rich Education Podcast. You can find that on iTunes, I'm assuming Stitcher and Google Play and pretty much everywhere else where, you know, podcasts can be found. And, you know, Keith is not, he's not an insignificant player out there. He interviews a lot of huge names like Robert Kiyosaki and Ken McElroy and Tom Wheelwright and lots of other people and has a ton of wisdom to share. So I would absolutely recommend you check it out. I've actually been on his show a couple times, and every episode I've ever heard of him, I'm just like, man, that was awesome. So totally check that out. And also for the show notes for this episode, they're going to be at retipster.com/45, where you can find links to all of Keith's stuff. You know, the whole recording, you can listen to this on the website if you want. And Keith, before we wrap this up, is there anything else you want to share?
if you want to get the book that I was talking about, I'm not even trying to sell the book, Seven Money Myths That Are Killing Your Wealth Potential. We touched just briefly on some of the myths today. You can get the ebook completely free. I think the paper book's less than $10 on Amazon, but the ebook's completely free at getricheducation.com for a little while longer right now. And you know, it's not a lengthy book. Not only is it just 84 pages, it's 84 small pages. Seth knows, he's read it. You could probably fit it into 45, you know, bigger or regular size pages. So it's about keeping it compact, because I'm not only trying to solve the problem of financial education, it's to solve the reading problem that we have. You know, most people don't read because they didn't finish the last book they read because it was 380 pages. So Seven Money Myths That Are Killing Your Wealth Potential is a short book, and you can get the e-version of something that's really going to dramatically change your life, your mindset, and your actions at GetRichEducation.com.
Cool. Now, if somebody doesn't have time to read the book, if you're able to summarize that entire book in one word, what would that word be?
Abundance.
Oh, good.
Dang.
Awesome.
Kudos, man. That was good.
It was very good. All right, Keith. Thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it, man. And hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
I loved it, fellas. Thanks so much.
So that was the show, everybody, with Keith. I hope you guys liked it. I know Jaron and I always enjoy talking with him. So something that we had actually been trying to do, and we totally lost track of it because a bunch of things happened. But in episode 39 with Willie Goldberg, we ended the show by giving our answer to question number one. And then in episode 40 with Derek Gallimore, we ended it by giving our answer to question number two. What are you most proud of? So that brings us to now, skipping forward a few episodes. Again, episode 45. We're both going to answer the question, what is the most important lesson you've ever learned? So, Jaron,
do you want to go first?
No.
No, not at all.
Have you thought this through? Do you need a second?
No, I have. Yeah, this was actually really easy for me to answer because me and my wife went through a stillbirth with our daughter 2 years ago in March. And we went through a very, very trying time. That was probably the hardest time in my life. Mm-hmm. And I learned the greatest lesson that I have learned so far, and I'm gonna have to go like a little bit spiritual on you guys. Like, I'm a Christian. If you're not a Christian, just like translate my words to non-Christian language, because I'm just speaking from my heart right now. But I have found that suffering and pain is a part of design, is a part of the way the world works. And it's even with stuff that I have, other projects that I've worked on with, like Perry Marshall's evolution project, that kind of thing, even inherently in evolution, mistakes and pain and suffering and problems is a part of the fabric of the way the world is just inherently. But, and this is a big but, I believe that pain, suffering, and chaos exist for the purpose for us to overcome. And that is the biggest lesson that I've learned and that I would want to share with the world, is that, one, don't be surprised when life knocks on your door. But two, when life knocks on your door and there's trouble, it's not a time to bow the knee and just say, whatever, it's time to fight. And that's the reason why it exists. That's the reason why opposition exists, is so that you can get in the fight, dig deep, and overcome and grow through the process.
Yeah. Have you ever heard the term rainbow baby?
Mm-mm.
I hadn't either until like a month ago. I saw it on Facebook. Somebody's like, post a picture of your rainbow baby. Apparently what that is when you have a child after experiencing some kind of miscarriage prior to that. So like, you obviously go through the horrendous, you know, devastating disappointment of that. But then it's followed up by, you know, a great, healthy baby.
Yeah.
And based on what you're saying there, I wonder, and I guess there's probably no way to really know this, but do you think your joy as a new parent is heightened at all, having going through that trial before? Like, if you had just had your first baby, everything was perfect, just went swimmingly well, I don't know. Do you feel like anything is like somehow better or enhanced as a result of what you went through?
Yeah. I mean, the way I say it is, if I had the option to go through the loss of our, because our daughter was born March 18th and was born at 36 weeks. So she was full term. And yeah. I mean, it was a very intense situation.
Pretty much the worst possible way to experience that.
And so I say, you know, if I had the choice to go through it again, I would choose to have my daughter here for sure. Like not, but a very close second would be to go through it again, because I now understand an insight into the goodness of God and the kindness of God that I otherwise would not be able to know because I was never tested, you know? Mm-hmm. And, in terms of my gratefulness for our son who was just born, that's why we're doing this so delayed, because I was all caught up in our son being born March 21st. When we have, you know, sleepless nights, or when my son is crying, or there's poopy diapers, I literally, and my wife is the same, I enjoy every second of it. I hold it so dear that I'm like, I remember we were driving from the hospital because we delivered in Indianapolis, even though we live in Chicago, because we really like my wife's OB there. And the three-hour drive, you know, baby's crying, and I'm like, I'm driving, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I've dreamed for this moment to have a crying baby in the backseat. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and most people, they're like, oh my gosh, and there's not to you know, not in a judgmental way at all, but it's just very, a lot of the feedback that we get are people are like, are you sleeping? It's really hard. Make sure you really enjoy it, because, you know, it's easy to just get caught up in the how drastically your life has changed with a newborn and all that. And maybe we're like just fortunate to have a pretty chill baby. Maybe there's like that aspect to it too. But in light of what we went through, I mean, I love the poopy diapers and the crying baby and the mm-hmm. stress and the chaos, because it's like, dude, we've literally fought for this. Like, my wife in particular, she was pronounced that she was infertile. Like, we went to infertility specialists. We did this whole long journey, but my wife never gave up the fight. And mm-hmm. the whole purpose, I think, of our daughter dying and not, and being stillbirth was for us to overcome. I'm just fully convinced of that.
That's interesting to hear you say that, man, because our experience was far more, you know, we had a miscarriage at 11 weeks, so not at all the same experience you went through, but it did teach me when our first daughter was finally born, which, by the way, never would have been born if the first one had been born, like just the timing of it wouldn't have worked. But, you know, after she showed up, and it was just an amazing thing. Like, I kind of knew inherently in that moment, like, this is not to be taken for granted. Like, so many things had to go right in order to get to this point. And, I know it's, I think when you have that perspective, when you've sort of been through the trial of that, like, you do sort of see it in a new light. Like, I'm with you. Like, I've actually never been bothered by changing diapers. Like, as disgusting as that can be, like, it's not the kind of thing that I dread. Like, I sort of see it as, like, it's a privilege to be able to do this. Like, to have this situation in the first place is not something everybody gets.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said for experiencing the low points of life. It's almost like God can teach you things through that you literally cannot learn any other way.
Yeah.
Like, it gives this the new platform that just makes a new perspective possible. So.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's different when it's your own kid, man. Like, the kid can spit up on me and I'm not grossed out. If it was somebody else's kid, I'd be totally grossed out. But I think there's just something, I don't know, some biology, something or other that's happened in there that I just am not grossed out by my kid.
So. Yeah, I've heard that said before too. And I think there's truth to that, because, yeah, I know what you mean. Like, it's a different thing if some other kid's, you know, vomits in front of me. Like, it's just like, sick, get away from me. But yeah, it's like the tolerance, like, it's amazing what I can tolerate. Like, I haven't really hit my limit yet, considering everything I've experienced so far. And I think I would have hit that limit a long time ago without somebody else's kid. So,
yeah, man.
But cool, man. Well, thanks for sharing that. That was really insightful to hear that. For me, I think I feel like I kind of copped out before too. I hesitate to say this is like the number one most important lesson ever, but this was a really big aha moment for me. And it happened for me when I was doing my MBA back in like from 2011 to 2013. And the school that I went to, Northwood University, the way it worked was it was a cohort. So you, for two straight years, you're in the same class of people and you're sitting around the table and you get to know them really, really well. You get to know everything that they're good and bad at. And some people you love, some people you hate, and you just got to deal with them. And something that hit me like a ton of bricks with this particular cohort, there were like at least five or six people in this group that were like super outspoken. And they were like pretty high positions in the companies they worked. Like they, you know, were, I don't know. Like, for example, one guy was a store manager at Meijer. And if you're not familiar with Meijer, it's basically like a Walmart. He ran the entire store. Another person was like a CFO at their company. Another person was like the head salesperson. And from different angles, each of these people, I think the reason they got to their position was because they were very good at displaying confidence. Mm. Like they knew how to make statements and just say like, this is how it is. This is the answer. And they said it with such conviction that like you would feel ridiculous arguing with them because they were just so sure of themselves. But as we kept going through these classes, I saw several instances where they would say these things and like I actually knew better. And I'm like, you're wrong. Like I know you're wrong. Like I know indisputably that you do not know what you're talking about. But like if I didn't have my own personal set of experiences, I would have just believed them because they were so confident. And I think the aha moment I had was that, you know, again, not in every situation, but in a lot of situations, confidence is a sign of ignorance. Because I think the older and wiser you get in life, the more you realize how much you don't know. Like there is a very, very, very small percentage of things in the universe that I can say I really know definitively. And so whenever I hear somebody come out just like, yep, this is how it is, like that always makes me step back and be like, whoa, okay. Like you probably don't actually know what you're talking about. Or there may be like an element of truth to what you're saying, but like what you're saying cannot be applied across the board like you seem to be thinking right now. So for me, it was just a big moment of realizing, you know, a confident statement does not automatically mean it's true. And also, it's disturbing almost to me how far in life or how far in their careers or in companies confident people can get when they really shouldn't. Like they're actually kind of dumb in many respects. Like there's things that they're just legitimately not good at or they shouldn't be trusted with. But because they know how to be confident, like the doors just swing wide open for them. And that really bothers me. It's almost like an injustice I see in the world, but that's kind of how human nature works. And for whatever reason, I never really realized that going on in humanity until I saw so many blatant examples of it in my experience there at Northwood. So I think that those people have probably always been out there in my life. It's just that like when I had two solid years to really get to know people and really understand what their core competencies were, it became very evident to me where people were kind of not that smart, but still acting like they were. So anyway, that's, again, I don't know if it's the most important lesson, but it is a very important lesson that I've learned in the past decade.
That's awesome. So. Well, hey, man, I want to throw something at you on the air here. Yeah. I've really enjoyed these little like 10, 15 minute like dress up powwows with, you know, Jaren and Seth. And I was wondering, like, is there a way that we could keep this going? Like, obviously, I like it because it's optional, right? People can just listen to the meat and potatoes and just ignore us. But for those that want to kind of get a more deeper side or whatever into how we tick, like, is there a way that at the end of every episode we could do this or should we even do that? Like, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, man, I've enjoyed it too. It's just kind of a different thing. And I think in a lot of ways, people don't really know who either of us are. Not that they need to, but if they care, if they want to, this is one way to kind of get to know us a little bit better. For me, it's kind of fun just talking about this stuff. Like,
yeah,
what makes us tick and the ways we think about the world. But yeah, I've been thinking about this too. And I was able to pick up this deck of conversation starters there's actually a bunch of different places you can get this kind of thing, but it's basically just this huge deck of cards. Each card has a thought-provoking question on it. For example, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be and why? You know, questions like that. So yeah, man, I think it's a great idea. If people start leaving comments and sending me emails saying, stop it, I don't care about you, you're annoying, shut up, then I guess we can stop that. But yeah, man, for I guess the foreseeable future, let's plan on doing that. We'll wrap up each episode with one of those questions and we can both chime in and share our thoughts. And hopefully the listeners out there will find some entertainment in that.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool.
So yeah, that sounds like a plan. Let's do that.
Well, again, everybody, thanks a lot for listening. Really glad we could have you along for the ride here. Show notes for this episode, again, retipster.com/45. Be sure to check out Keith Weinhold at getricheducation.com. And hopefully we will talk to you again next time. See ya.
Thanks for listening to the RE Tipster Podcast. For a full summary of this episode, stocked with links, show notes, and a lot more, check out the podcast archive page at retipster.com/podcast.